Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back studying the Torah portions. This week we're studying the portion Shemot, which means names, and is the Hebrew name of the book of Exodus. The reading this week is from Exodus 1:1 to 6:1. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, you can go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
In the portion of Shemot, we're told how the descendants of Israel multiplied into a nation and were forced into slavery in Egypt, and also how God chose and preserved his special servant Moses, whom he sent to deliver his people from the bondage imposed on them by Pharaoh and the Egyptians.
So this portion begins with basically a very Cliff Notes version of the end of Genesis. So if you remember in the previous portions in Genesis, we read that Joseph had ascended to being basically in charge of all of Egypt. And when a huge famine struck, Joseph was the only one who was able to provide for all the Egyptians and the surrounding nations, including his family, the sons of Jacob. So at this point, we read that after all of Israel's household came down to live in Egypt, their whole generation died, including Joseph, but their descendants multiplied and grew incredibly fruitful and became a huge nation living in Egypt.
This multiplying of the descendants of Israel, turning them into a nation, is the fulfillment of the promises God has been making for over 100 years. When he promised to Abraham, his seed would be a blessing to all the families of the earth through a nation, a chosen special nation, and that nation is Israel. God is finally bringing about what we've been waiting for basically all of Genesis.
But in addition to the promises that God made to Abraham that he would make his descendants a great nation, God also promised all the way back in Genesis 15, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years.
And that suffering begins when a new king comes over Egypt. He doesn't know Joseph. He doesn't know the people of Israel. All he knows is
there are lots of Jews.
There are lots of Israelis, and they're all in his land, and he sees them as a domestic threat. And so his response to God's blessing of the nation of Israel is, we have to keep them down. Mm. We have to set taskmasters over them so that they're afflicted and they're laboring so they can't get stronger and more mighty. That concept of the more they're blessed, the more they're hated is something we've seen hints of all throughout Genesis. Pharaoh's now doing it on a much larger scale because Israel is much larger than
exactly.
They've ever been before. But it actually says, well, the more they multiplied, the more Egypt oppressed them.
The more Egypt oppressed them, the more they multiplied.
Exactly. So even though the Egyptians were the ones oppressing the Hebrews, it says the Egyptians were actually in dread of the people of Israel. So as Israel continues to increase, Egypt increases the level of oppression until eventually they decide, we're going to take this to a much worse extent. Mm.
Egypt then proceeds to do genocide. They demand that all baby boys born to Hebrews be killed.
Pharaoh says, we have to keep the Hebrew boys from being born. He finds the Hebrew midwives and he says to them, when you're delivering a baby, if you see that it's a boy, kill him on the spot. Keep the birth from happening, basically. But the midwives, it says they feared God. They weren't going to be a party to genocide, so they didn't do it. They delivered the babies. They let them live.
And then they lied to Pharaoh to basically make up an excuse for why baby boys weren't dying. And God blessed them for that, for lying to protect life. God blessed them for that and established their houses.
Yeah, it took faith to do that. They're actively opposing the king who's given them a direct order because they fear God. They fear God more than they fear the king.
We must obey God rather than obey men.
Exactly. It's a sense of priority. If you trust that God will provide for you and that he'll punish you if you do evil more than you
fear what man can do to you,
then you will make the right choice. You'll follow the right one, and God will bless you for that in the long run. But Pharaoh's not going to be content to just let this go. He wants genocide, and he's going to have it. So he says, fine then, if you can't stop it at birth, we're going to take all the boys, and we're going to throw them into the river.
This suffering of the people of Israel is ingrained in our history. Every year at Passover, we remember this. It shows that from the very moment our people became a nation, we've had to deal with suffering. A lot of the absolute monstrosities that Pharaoh inflicted on us here, those didn't stay in Egypt. Those have followed us wherever we've gone. I mean, there are so many parallels here to the Holocaust. It reminded me of the concentration camps where the people who weren't killed on the spot, like the baby boys, were forced to do all sorts of labor in ways unfathomable. But no matter how horrible things can get for our people, God does always hear our cries. He does always remember us, and he will deliver us out of those, as we will see very shortly here.
The persecution here in Egypt and the persecution of the Holocaust in Germany and everything that Israel has suffered in between, they all stem from this same sort of jealousy and fear toward God's people, because God blesses them and because God chose them for a special purpose. Whenever God's greatness is shown through Israel, people hate Israel. And as we're going to see later, this hatred of Israel ultimately traces back to a hatred of the God who chose them.
Psalm 83 says, "Behold, your enemies make an uproar. Those who hate you," so talking to God, "those who hate you have exalted themselves. They make shrewd plans against your people and conspire against your treasured ones. They have said, 'Come and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more.'" So when people hate God, that will inevitably work out as anti-Semitism, as wanting to destroy God's people, Israel.
He is the God of Israel. And so if you hate the God of Israel and you don't want to hear his name anymore,
you have to wipe out the Israel.
Yeah. And so it is in the midst of all of this hatred of God and his people and the affliction of the Hebrews that God is preparing the deliverance of his people.
So as Pharaoh is commanding all the Hebrews to kill their male children, one Levite has a son, but she is not going to let the decree of the king kill her son. She's not going to throw him into the river. She places him in a basket in the river.
Yeah, it actually says she hid him for 3 months first. So she kept him as long as she could. But eventually she realized she couldn't keep him any longer. They were going to find him eventually. So she does what she can to keep her baby alive. This is another example of faith, kind of like how the midwives had faith. What it says in Hebrews is, by faith, Moses was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the decree of the king. So it's the same thing we already said. When you have faith in God, you're not afraid of man. She wasn't afraid of what punishment the king would have.
Yeah.
Because she knew what the right thing to do was.
I'm also reminded of what Yeshua says, where he says, "Do not fear man who is able to kill you and then afterwards has nothing to do to you. Rather, fear him who, after the killing of the body, is able to throw both body and soul into the Gehinnom." It says the midwives feared God. The Levite woman is showing that same fear of God, but not fear of the king.
And the child which she's protecting this way turns out to be a very special child. Having committed him to the river, committing him to God, really, the baby ends up being taken to where the daughter of Pharaoh himself is bathing. So when Pharaoh's daughter sees this basket with a child in it, she's trying to figure out, what am I going to do with this baby? Someone approaches her. It's actually the baby's sister. And what she says to Pharaoh's daughter is, "I know a woman who can nurse this baby. can I go take this baby to her to be nursed? And Pharaoh's daughter says, yes, please do that for me. So this baby actually ends up being brought back to his mother legally now.
Yeah.
The mother doesn't have to be afraid of what's going to happen to her baby anymore because Pharaoh's daughter saw the baby and said, I want this one for my own once he's nursed. And so the mother's able to nurse her child. And then once he's older, then he's finally brought back to Pharaoh's daughter to be raised not just as a Hebrew, but as the grandson of Pharaoh, as an Egyptian. And this baby is actually named Moses because Pharaoh's daughter drew him up out of the water. And the name Moshe means to draw up. So this is Moses, God's chosen deliverer through whom God will accomplish great things.
And this situation where Moses comes from, where he is spared as all the other baby boys are dying, this is actually a messianic foreshadowing. When Yeshua is born, King Herod says to kill all of the baby Jewish boys, two and younger, in Bethlehem. And Yeshua actually ends up needing to flee to Egypt to be spared from this genocide. So the same pattern of where Yeshua came from as a baby, that's the same thing that happened with Moses. As we read through the Torah, we'll see a number of parallels between Moses and Yeshua. As we'll see later, Yeshua is a prophet like Moses. And so this is the beginning. All the way from the beginning of Moses' life, he already is showing some of those messianic themes. So after this, we learn that Moses grows up and he decides to look in on his Hebrew brothers. And when he goes out there, he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. This Hebrew is one of his brothers. All Israelites are his brothers. And so when he sees this Egyptian mistreating his kinsman, he looks around, sees no one else is there, and then he kills the Egyptian and he hides his body. So from this, we're already seeing that Moses deeply cares about his people and he doesn't want to see them being mistreated. He hates what the Egyptians are doing to the Hebrews, and he's willing to go to extreme lengths to make it stop.
What Moses wants is justice for his people. Mm. And so we see that in him delivering his afflicted brother who's being mistreated from this Egyptian. Mm. But then we also see it the next day when he goes out again and he sees two Hebrews quarreling and he tries to mediate. He is trying to make everything right and just between the two of them. He's figuring out which one's in the wrong and he's saying, why are you fighting with him? Why are you striking him?
Yeah.
He's trying to make everything right and just. And so it's interesting. On the one hand, he's delivering his people. And on the other hand, he's mediating.
And judging.
Yeah. And judging. So a lot of different roles that we see in Moses that we're going to see more in Moses later. Mm. And which are all qualities which Yeshua has.
He is trying to make things right for his people. And his people's response is, who are you? You aren't in charge. Even though, as we'll see very quickly here, Moses is the one that God raised up to be in charge.
It's very interesting. Their question is rhetorical. Who made you a prince and a judge over us? But there's an answer. The answer is, God made him the prince and judge over them.
We already mentioned this in a previous portion, but basically we'd already seen with Joseph how when God gave him the dream saying that he would be over his brothers, they rejected him. And that same pattern is being repeated in Moses. And again, to reiterate what we said in that previous episode, this same pattern is repeated in Yeshua. As Stephen himself points out, Yeshua was raised up to be the king of the Jews, but the leaders rejected him, stirred up the people, and got Yeshua crucified. And to this day, the majority of Jewish people reject Yeshua's authority as the Messiah of Israel. But after Moses is rejected, we'll see that God will still end up putting him in charge. And in the same way, despite how the people of Israel have historically and continue today to reject Yeshua as Messiah, one day he will be made king over all of Israel.
In the middle of this backlash to Moses being a ruler over them, a judge between them, the Hebrew says to Moses, "Are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian?" And Moses realized, how did he find out I killed the Egyptian? That was supposed to be hidden. Probably everyone knows about it. I have to get away. Because when Pharaoh hears about it, he wants to kill Moses. Mm. So now Moses is suddenly a fugitive. He flees and he goes down to Midian. Mm. So he just went from being a Hebrew boy destined to death to
the grandson of
the
Pharaoh.
Adoptive grandson of Pharaoh, to now he's an exile and a sojourner in a completely strange land.
His own people have said, "Who put you in charge? Are you going to kill us?" The Egyptians who he was raised with now want to kill him. So basically, everything that Moses has ever known is gone. Everyone has turned their back on Moses, and he's left in a country that he has no clue about.
But here he'll begin to rebuild. In the land of Midian, he ends up being by a well when the daughters of a priest of Midian come to the well to get water, but they aren't able to get the water because
other shepherds are harassing them.
Right. Moses' reaction is to stand up and save them and water their flock. So once again, even as an exile, Moses is being a deliverer.
He's showing his character in that when he sees someone being wronged, he steps in to make it right.
I think even here, some messianic parallels can be drawn in how he tried to come to deliver his people. They rejected him.
So now he's delivering others who aren't his people.
Yeah, when he ends up delivering other nations that he wasn't even sent to. Mm-hmm. But later, he'll be back. He will deliver his people with great power and signs. Mm. So it's a parallel to what we see today. Even as Yeshua was rejected by his people, the good news of what he did went out to the Gentiles, and some of them received it.
Yeah.
And some of them were saved through him. Even though he wasn't sent to them, they end up being saved through him. And through their reception of him, sooner or later, he'll be back to deliver his own people.
Yeah. And when that happens, there'll be life out of the dead for everyone in every nation.
But after Moses delivers these daughters of the priest of Midian, the priest of Midian, here's what he did. And he invites him to come live with them. He gives him one of his daughters to be Moses' wife.
Yeah.
And Moses has a son. Mm. And so he's rebuilding.
But meanwhile, it says that years pass and the people of Israel are still suffering. They're still in slavery and they're still crying out to God. And it says that their cry went up, and God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It says, God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. So I just want to reiterate that this slavery of the people of Israel took 400 years. They kept calling out for justice and salvation and deliverance for 400 years. And that whole time, it seemed like God had forgotten them, I would imagine. But he did hear. And yet, for 400 years, he did nothing. And so, what I want to point out is, just because you ask God for something and he doesn't give it, doesn't mean he's abandoned you, doesn't mean he's forgotten about you, it doesn't mean that he can't hear you. All that it means is that he hasn't done what you asked yet. And Yeshua says that when you pray, you need to have shameless persistence. You need to keep praying and not lose heart. When God promises you something, he is going to do it no matter what. But that doesn't mean he'll do it right now, or he'll do it in the way that you expect. Sometimes a path of suffering is needed before that deliverance can come. And we just have to accept that and know that God knows best. Pray for what we need and trust that he will always hear you and always be faithful.
We already read, God had told Abraham that this was going to happen. This is the fulfillment of God's covenant. It doesn't say he remembered his covenant for no reason. He remembered his covenant because in his covenant, he said,
they're going to be slaves in
400 years is the time that they will be slaves. And the 400 years was up, and God remembered that. God knew that. And he said, okay, now I'm sending the deliverer. But even during the 400 years that they were waiting, what was God doing? He was multiplying them, even as they were oppressed. He was preparing his deliverer. Moses was 80 when he went before Pharaoh at the end of those 400 years, which means that for 80 years of the people of Israel being oppressed and afflicted and forced to work and being murdered, God was preparing their deliverance. They couldn't see it. They didn't know it. But God was preparing their deliverance in a perfect way.
And so it's at this point when God hears the cries of his people. It's been 400 years, and his deliverer Moses is in Midian, that God calls Moses. Moses is pasturing the flock of his father-in-law, and he comes to Mount Horeb, which is probably more commonly known as Mount Sinai. It's here that Moses sees the burning bush. The messenger or angel of God is in the bush, and it looks like a burning fire, but the bush isn't being consumed.
Moses says, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And so then it's when he goes aside to see what's going on, that's when God is able to speak to him and call him. And I thought that was a good image of how we as Messiah followers can be for others. When God is in us, people can see it. So it can take someone who's just going about their own business and divert their attention, cause them to see and turn toward God. Yeshua tells us to let our light shine before men so they can see and glorify your Father who's in the heavens. This bush is doing that same thing. Moses is seeing a miracle. He's seeing the
fire. Power of God.
Yeah, and he wants to know what's causing it. And when he gets there, then God is able to reveal himself to Moses and speak to him. And so we should strive to be that for others. We should let God and his spirit living in us burn in us without consuming us. And anyone who sees it will want to know, how is this happening? What is this? And then God can speak to them through you if you're being led by his spirit and his spirit lives in you.
The concept of being a fire, it reminded me of Acts 2. In Acts 2, when the Spirit showed up, there were tongues of fire that were on each of their heads, and they were filled with the Spirit, and everyone in Jerusalem was like, what on earth is going on? And it enabled them to proclaim the good news of Yeshua, and thousands of Jews were saved. So that's a really good picture of the light of God shining in us to other people. So it's at this point that when Moses comes to look at the burning bush, that God himself speaks to Moses out of the bush. And he calls his name, Moses, Moses. And he says, here I am. And God says, this is holy ground. You need to take off your shoes. Don't come any closer. But then he says, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So before this point, Moses just was like, what on earth is this? And then suddenly, the God of your ancestors who lived 400 years ago is now speaking to you. So Moses is rightly filled with fear. He's in the presence of God, a God that he's just been hearing about for his life, but he's never interacted with God before.
But while Moses is hiding his face from God, God's words to Moses are, I'm choosing you. I want you, and I'm going to send you to Pharaoh because I've seen what the Egyptians are doing to my people, and I'm sending you to deliver them from Egypt. And Moses' response is, who am I? I'm just some guy. But what God says to Moses is, I will be with you.
It doesn't matter who you are, because God will be with you.
Exactly. We've seen before that God was with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. all people he chose for special things. And now he's choosing Moses, and he's giving him this special call.
I also want to point out, this is jumping just a little bit back here, but right before he calls Moses himself, he says the reason why he's calling Moses is because I have seen the affliction of my people. I know their pain, and I've come to deliver them to the promised land, to the land of the Canaanites. So as God is choosing Moses, he's also showing compassion. He's not just a fireball that'll consume everything.
Yeah.
He's on a mission of salvation because he has compassion for his people. And he's already showing the character that he has.
And he's telling Moses right now, it's through you that I'm going to bring about that mission of salvation. It's very interesting. He says, I have sent you. This is the first time it's specifically God sends someone to his people. With Joseph, God chose him for a specific purpose.
And sent him to Egypt.
He put him in the right place so that his people could come to him. But this is, Moses was cast out. He was away from his people. And God is saying, I'm going to send you to be in the midst of my people and deliver them as my emissary, my messenger sent to them. And so that's a unique relationship that...
Again, parallels Yeshua.
There are lots of prophets and such in between Moses and Yeshua that have that same call of being sent. That's kind of part of the call of a prophet. And so it's in that sense that Yeshua is a prophet like Moses, that both of them have that common sentness.
But unlike the other prophets of Israel, Yeshua was sent from God. Yeshua was in God's form, and he had to give that up and take on the form of a man and be sent to dwell with his people. So in that sense, where Moses is away from his people and he's sent to them, so also Yeshua is sent from the right hand of God himself, and he's sent to his people. So at this point, the God of his ancestors has called Moses. And he's like, I'm going to send you to your people. I'm going to deliver your people. And then Moses' response is, I don't even know your name. The people of Israel don't even know God's name. And so he says, when I say the God of your father sent me to you, and they say, what's his name? What should I say? And so then God responds, Eyeh asher eyeh, which means I am who I am. And then he says, I am has sent me to you. This name here of Eyeh Asher Eyeh, it basically states that God is God. He is. He always will be. He always was. And there's nothing like him. Like, what can you compare God to? He just is. It just is an amazing expression of his holiness and his singularness in his power. But then he continues and he says, Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. So here he says the name Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, but then he ties that to the patriarchs, to the fathers of the people of Israel. And then he says that that's his name forever. That's how he wants to be remembered, is as the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob.
He's tying his name directly to everything we've read in Genesis about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He's saying, without that, without this promised people, the people of Israel, God's name becomes meaningless. Going back to what we said earlier about how people who hate God want to wipe out the name of Israel. Because God tied his reputation, tied his name to be remembered forever to the people of Israel and to the covenants that he made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And part of that covenant is the covenant of the land. And so he goes on to say, Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, God of your fathers, God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, says, I have observed you, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, a land flowing with milk and honey.
Yeah.
He's saying, I am the God who made these covenants.
And I am the God who keeps these covenants.
I am the God of your people, and I am. And since I am, and I made these covenants, I am going to fulfill them.
That is a powerful statement. Basically, God is saying, you know everything that you've read about in Genesis? That's who I am. And that's who I will be going forward. This is basically a promise of God being the same forever. When he says, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, this is my memorial name forever. He's saying this is never going to change. I'm never going to not be the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. I am never not going to be the God of your fathers, the God of the Hebrews. And so this is like one of the most key defining moments of God's relationship with our people, where he's revealing, this is who I am. I am who I am. And I always will be who I am. Now, a few times in this discussion, we've mentioned the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is often rendered Lord in these translations. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is the Hebrew spelling of the name, but we aren't actually pronouncing it. And the reason why is because we don't know the pronunciation, but there's actually an episode of the Biblically Correct podcast all about the sacred name of God, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, what we know about it, how we should relate to it and such. And so if you want to see more about that aspect of things, you can go check out that podcast.
So then God proceeds to basically tell Moses his rescue plan for Israel. He says, I'm sending you. You are going to go speak to Pharaoh. Pharaoh is not going to listen unless he's compelled by a mighty hand. And so God says, I will stretch out my hand. And so he's going to strike Egypt with wonders. He's telling Moses that he's going to do the plagues to Egypt. And after that, Pharaoh will let them go. And he adds on top of this, then the people of Israel are going to plunder the Egyptians and take silver and gold and jewelry and clothing. God just told Moses everything
about the Exodus. Huge spoiler alert for the rest of Exodus.
But it just goes to show that he knows the end from the beginning. He's sending Moses knowing exactly what is going to have to happen before the people of Israel come out.
Yeah.
And he's showing that all of this is part of his plan. I mean, he already told Abraham they were going to come out of the land with many possessions. So now telling Moses they're going to plunder the Egyptians and come out with many possessions isn't necessarily new. But he's going into detail. He's telling Moses like every step about what's going to happen. And it's showing the sureness with which Moses can trust these words are reliable and that the people of Israel are going to come out if Moses goes as he is sent.
But then Moses' immediate reply is, but what if they don't believe me? What do I do then? You're telling me all this, but what if they don't believe me? And so God's like, well, what do you got there in your hand? And Moses is like, this is a staff. God's like, throw that. It's like, okay. He throws it and it becomes a serpent and he freaks out and he runs away. But then Moses says, stretch out your hand and grab it by the tail. And so Moses does grab it, and then it becomes a staff again. God also gives him another sign. He puts his hand in his coat, and then when he pulls it out, it's all diseased, and it's white and stuff, and then he puts it back and takes it back out, and it's all better. And then God also gives him a third sign that he can take some water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, and it'll turn into blood. And he basically says, if they don't believe you, do these things. These things will prove I sent you, because they're miracles. You can't do those by yourself. God is giving these actions, these miracles, to Moses as a witness and a testimony that he was sent by God. And that reminded me of Yeshua again. Yeshua says in John that his actions testify about him. So just like Moses, where God is giving him miracles to do, when Yeshua came, he was doing all sorts of miracles left and right, and everyone in Israel heard about it, and it was a testimony that he was, in fact, sent by God. So again, more messianic foreshadowing in Moses.
So I want to point out that all through this conversation, it's been a conversation. God is saying things to Moses, and Moses is answering back.
Mm.
And Moses is asking questions, and he's like, I'm
he's
not sure we're on
his
the
concerns.
Same page. Yeah, so this is really a unique relationship.
Mm.
We've only really seen it with one other figure, which is Abraham. Abraham was able to talk with God as a man talks with his friend. But Isaac and Jacob and all the 12 tribes. And
even like Noah.
Noah, no one else has had this relationship with God.
Mm.
It's really reserved for the people who God chooses for really special things.
Mm.
And so it's just showing how close God is with Moses and how close he'll continue to be. This is the first time of many that God and Moses talk directly to one another on a level almost.
Yeah, but as we'll see pretty quickly here, Moses takes it a little bit too far.
He does.
he goes from conversing with God to being questioning toward God. And he basically says, please send someone else. I don't talk good. And you want me to talk. So can't you send someone else?
And God's reply is, I made your mouth. I could make you mute, or I could make you deaf, or I could make you blind, or I can make you see. I am Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Which we already just saw how important that name is,
yeah.
How much is it tied to that.
Yeah.
And he's now saying, all of that weight of all that I did in Genesis, by that, I have the power to make you talk good. And so therefore, go. I will be with you. To be with Moses' mouth and teach him what he should speak. But Moses says, please, no.
And so then God gets angry. It's absolutely ridiculous. God made Moses. God knows exactly who Moses is. And God chose Moses. If he wanted someone different, he would have chosen someone different because he is. He is God. But he didn't. He chose Moses. God knows who he wants. And Moses has the audacity to say, I think you got the wrong guy.
Yeah, Moses is resisting God's call.
Hmm.
He's saying, I'm too weak. Whereas God is saying, it's my power by which I send you.
Hmm.
And Moses is saying, no, my weakness makes this impossible. Well, with men it may be impossible, but with God all things are possible. But because of Moses' resistance to God's call, God says, fine then, I'll send someone else who can do that part.
But because, I'll also send you.
Yeah, I'm still sending you.
Mm.
But he says, you have a brother, Aaron, and he can speak well, so fine. He'll speak for you.
Mm.
But you're going to tell him everything to say.
Yeah.
God still chose Moses, and he's not moving in that. He's saying, you are the one I will speak to.
Mm.
You are the one I will give my signs.
Mm.
I will prove my power in you, Moses, whether you're going to resist that call or not.
Mm.
But I will give you Aaron as a helper.
What it's supposed to be is, I speak to you, and then you speak to the people. But instead, what's going to happen is, Moses is going to have the words from God, and he'll tell it to Aaron to tell to the people. Moses is just overly complicated things. God had a plan, and Moses was like, no, let's do it different. And so God's like, fine, we'll do it different. But we're still going to do it my way.
What God's plan was to be with Moses' mouth and teach him what he should speak.
Mm.
And that reminded me of some things Yeshua said about us. Yeshua said, when they bring you before the synagogues and the rulers and the authorities, be not anxious about how or what you may reply or what you may say. For the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, will teach you in that moment what you must say.
Mm.
It's very similar to what God is saying to Moses. He's saying, in the moment, I'm going to teach you what you need to say. And so Yeshua is saying, don't be anxious. Don't resist the call. Just speak what he teaches you to speak when he teaches you to speak it.
Mm.
Be humble and submissive to be used by God.
Mm.
You may be weak, but God is powerful. let him use you.
It says that God chose the weak things of the world to show his power. God can use your weakness. If you are a weak person in any area, God can do strong things in your weak areas to show this isn't coming from you. This isn't your own strength. This is God working through you. Your weakness can be a testimony to God's power.
If you let it be that way.
Mm.
If, like Moses, you resist the call, then God will prove his power another way. Mm. He'll use someone else. One way or another, his will be done. The question is,
are you going to go along with it?
Exactly. So, after all this is sorted out, God has finally finished talking to Moses. Mm. So, Moses prepares to go back to Egypt. And God says one more thing to him. He says, go back to Egypt, for all the men who are seeking your life are dead. That sounds pretty straightforward. But I was reminded that that's another messianic parallel. The same story we talked about earlier.
With King Herod.
Where Herod wanted to kill Yeshua.
Mm-hmm.
After Herod died, God said to Yeshua's father, Joseph, go back, for those who are seeking your life have died.
Mm. It's very almost, similar
it's
language.
It's almost a direct quote.
Yeah.
So showing the same thing, just as Moses in his
infancy
was reflecting that story of everyone wanting to kill the deliverer before he delivered.
Mm.
So also when he was being persecuted and had to flee to Midian, mm. that was a foreshadowing of the same event.
Mm.
And so the waiting as a sojourner until those seeking your life die and then coming back to deliver your people
mm.
is something that Moses and Yeshua have in common.
Is it clear yet that Moses and Yeshua have similarities? So then as God sends out Moses to go back to Egypt, he then confirms, when you go to see Pharaoh, tell him, thus says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And then he says, let my son go that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. So we've already talked about how special Israel is to God, but this is just God really, really reaffirming that and saying that Israel is his son. And the price on Pharaoh for holding his son hostage is that God is going to kill Pharaoh's son.
Once again, showing he knows everything that's about to happen.
Mm.
And also showing he's giving Pharaoh fair warning. He's telling Pharaoh the worst of what he's going to do before he started to do any of it. And then we're going to see he's going to incrementally work his way up to it.
Mm. Giving Pharaoh every chance to turn back.
But he told Pharaoh from the beginning what the punishment was going to be. And we're going to see Pharaoh didn't care.
Mm.
Pharaoh didn't believe it.
And I think this also speaks to just going forward. God says that whoever touches Israel touches the apple of God's eye. One does not simply attack Israel and get away with it. Even we see later with Babylon, when they tried to destroy Israel, and God had even wanted that destruction for punishment or whatnot, but God didn't let Babylon go unpunished. No one can persecute the Jewish people without exacting a heavy price on their heads. And God is establishing why here, because Israel is his firstborn son.
So Moses is going down to Egypt on his mission,
mm-hmm.
and he's taking his family with him. And it says, at a lodging place on the way, God actually came to try to kill Moses. And it goes on to explain some more context
mm.
when his wife then takes his son, cuts off his foreskin, and throws it before the feet of Moses to stop all this. Moses hadn't circumcised his son.
That's a big deal. That's basically one of the only commands that the people of Israel have at this point. The Torah hasn't been given. What's been given is God commanded Abraham and all of his offspring after him, circumcise your son on the eighth day. And Moses didn't do that.
God said, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That's my name forever. And he remembers his covenants. And
including now the covenant of circumcision.
He's calling on Moses to do the same thing. And Moses, he's like, what? Circumcision? And so this is so important. God's like, I'm going to kill you. And it's his wife that saves him.
Mm.
But it's very strange because, like, as soon as this has happened, okay, his son's circumcised now. That's the end of it.
Well, that's kind of the end of it, but we'll read way later in the Torah. Well, actually, I don't even know if we'll read it in the Torah. I think it might just be in Joshua. The entire generation that went to conquer the land of Canaan, none of them were circumcised. The generation that went out from Egypt, they didn't circumcise any of their children. Moses was there leading them the whole time in the 40 years, and he didn't have them circumcise their kids. Moses is the one that God will give the Torah through, but he himself is kind of neglecting that Torah. It's crazy. But I think that just again speaks to the concept. We've said it multiple times. God works through flawed people. Even people who not just they're talking back to God, they're resisting God, they're disobeying God. Moses disobeyed God, but God's still going to use him as the deliverer. He's still the archetype for the Messiah.
Yeah, God still has that special relationship with Moses. Mm. And while God was going to kill him for being in sin, once he's not in the sin anymore because his son is circumcised,
that puts an end to it.
Yeah. There's forgiveness there. It's never mentioned again. And God still has a purpose, and he still needs Moses for that purpose. So he's still sending Moses. So he not only sends Moses, he sends Aaron to meet Moses.
Mm-hmm.
They meet together. Moses tells him everything God told him, just like we said was supposed to happen. And then Moses and Aaron...
off to Pharaoh we go.
Well, first...
oh.
Off to the people of Israel.
Right.
And Aaron speaks to the people what Moses told to Aaron, what God told to Moses. through this game of telephone, as it were, the people hear what God's plan is and that God has remembered them and that he's here to deliver them.
Mm.
And they believe and they bow and worship.
Mm.
And everything's looking pretty great for the people of Israel until it isn't.
So now Moses and Aaron are ready to go and appear before Pharaoh. And they say, thus says Adonai, God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. Now, interestingly, what we're all familiar with is Moses basically says, let my people go. If you don't, here's a plague. This time, however, this very first time, Moses doesn't threaten Pharaoh at all. What he says is, if you don't let us go, God will fall on us, the Hebrews, with pestilence and with the sword because we didn't do the sacrifice that he wanted. This very first time that they're appearing before Pharaoh, they're giving him the chance, the opportunity to act not because he's being threatened, not because of his own sense of self-preservation, but out of pity and selflessness and wanting to help the people.
And more than that, he's not even being very... strict in terms of let us go forever.
Mm, it's just 3 days' journey.
Yeah, let us go 3 days' journey so that we can have a feast. And Pharaoh's not even willing to let them do that. Pharaoh's response is very telling. It goes back to some of the things we've said before about how people who hate God hate Israel and about how God tied his name to the people of Israel.
Mm.
He says, who is Adonai, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? That I should obey his voice and let Israel go. I do not know Adonai, and moreover, I will not let Israel go. So it's this direct juxtaposition. Moses hasn't threatened Pharaoh, but what he said is, this is the command of the living God, the God of Israel. And Pharaoh's response is, I don't know that God, so why should I care for his people? I don't believe in the God of Israel, so when he tells me to treat the people of Israel well, why should I do that?
Mm.
And instead he answers, Moses and Aaron, the reason why you came up with this is because you're too lazy and idle. You need to work more. That's the solution to this. Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh imploring him to let the people go. His response is to make things harder for the people of Israel.
Mm.
His response is to say they need to work more. And here's how they're going to do it. They're not going to get straw to make their bricks anymore.
They're going to have to gather it themselves, but make the same amount of bricks.
So increasing the difficulty, but not decreasing the workload. He says, let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words.
Mm.
So he's basically saying, the reason why I'm making them work harder is so that they'll forget about God because
he's trying to he's trying to break their hope and expectation for salvation and freedom by making their circumstances worse.
What I'm seeing is that Pharaoh is actively using work and the struggles of life to distract people from God. I think that's something we can all learn from. When work becomes an obstacle to God, you have to choose God. What Moses is asking is for 3 days' journey to go out into the wilderness to worship God.
And not be working.
He's not even saying we need to go away forever. He's saying we need to take some time to serve God. Everyone needs to take some time to serve God.
God picked one day a week for that.
But what Pharaoh is saying is, no, we need work to absorb their lives completely so they have no time for God. And that is a danger that any one of us can fall into.
Yeah.
The things of this world, the things we can see, our schedules, our to-do lists, can all stand in the way of God if we let them fill up our whole lives.
Absolutely.
We need God to fill up our whole lives. And then what we do from there should be devoted to serving him. If we work, it should be
to glorify him.
Exactly.
Another aspect of this that I found interesting, in addition to just using the work to distract from God, he's also using the work to basically disprove God. He's basically saying, your God wants you to stop working. Well, now you're going to work even harder. Where's your God now? Basically, Pharaoh's put another setback, supposedly, in God's plan. And so, the people's response then is, they say to Moses and Aaron, may Adonai judge you because you've made us stink in the eyes of Pharaoh. And Moses says, God, why did you send me in the first place? You haven't delivered us at all. You've done harm to your people. But they're missing the fact that God said Pharaoh would harden his heart. God said, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. So God knew this would happen. He said it would happen. But they don't see the fulfillment of the promise now, which goes back to what we were saying about how for 400 years they were asking God for deliverance and he waited. When God says he's going to give you something, sometimes there will be quote unquote setbacks. But that doesn't mean God's failing. It just means it's not time yet.
It also goes to what we were talking about earlier about how the more they were being blessed by God, the more the Egyptians were hating them and oppressing them. God has sort of brought the matter to a head. He's saying, yes, you've been dealing with my people and you've been seeing my blessings, but now I'm here, right here, speaking to you. And so that provokes them to take it further. They're leaning into it. Like they've been doing for 400 years. God made his presence more known, and they made their hatred more known. What they did by increasing the difficulty but not changing the workload is they've made it impossible for the people of Israel to do what Egypt is requiring of them. And so they're using that opportunity to beat the people of Israel. They've gone from forced labor to just straight up assaulting them and injuring them.
And there's nothing they can do about it.
And so the people's response is to blame Moses.
And Moses' response is to blame God.
This leads to a very difficult topic of blaming God. Moses is seeing the evil, and he's saying, it's because God sent me. And so now he's turning to God, and he's saying, why did you do this evil to your people? He's accusing God of being responsible for the suffering. But what's really telling is God's answer. He doesn't answer the question directly. Why did you do this? He doesn't affirm or deny anything Moses is saying.
He doesn't take responsibility or say it wasn't my fault.
What he says is, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand, he will send them out. And with a strong hand, he will drive them out of his land. So Moses is saying, why did you do this? He's blaming God for the evil that his people are suffering. And God is saying, wait. Watch. I'm about to show you my good. I'm about to do what I promised. And that's the response all of us should have. Instead of blaming God when we come upon bad circumstances, suffering, persecution, we should look to God. We should wait for him because we know what he's promised. And he said, I'm going to do it. what you have right now doesn't matter if God told you what is going to be.
God works all things together for good to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. This evil that the people of Israel are suffering, does it seem like they didn't need to go through that first? That they didn't need to get this added, your slavery is worse before you get saved? Maybe, but this is how God chose to deliver his people. This was God's plan. And it is a good plan because in the end, his people are saved, his power is known, and everyone can see that God is with Israel. Adonai says that his ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are his ways higher than our ways. We cannot question God. We cannot blame God. It is not our place. We don't know what God knows, and we aren't as righteous as God is. Adonai is who he is, and we are who we are, which is not God. And so we have to trust him and believe that if we serve him and love him, then he will work everything out for good for us.
Moses' response of blaming God is accompanied with questioning of his plan. He says, why have you done evil? And why did you send me? Moses thinks that the people of Israel would be better off if God had never sent Moses.
But if God had never sent Moses, then they would never get freed.
So questioning God's plan and blaming him nullifies your ability to see his plan and to see his good and to see his deliverance. But he will bring about that deliverance if you believe and if you wait. Just as he promises here, he will deliver the people of Israel. So this was a very densely packed portion, and there is a ton of good stuff to get from this. But I think a good central takeaway from this boils down to a very small point. Obey God's call. The midwives obeyed God's call when they wouldn't put to death the babies. Moses obeyed God's call when he refused to be called a son of the daughter of Pharaoh. And when he tried to mediate on behalf of his people, Moses refused God's call when God said, I will put my words in your mouth and you will speak to Pharaoh and to the people. And when he refused that call, it made God angry. But he found another way to do it. All along the way, God has a plan and he picks people. He calls them to fulfill his purpose, to glorify his name. And it's our responsibility and duty to obey that call in whatever way we can. If we don't do that, God will still get what he wants, but things will be worse for us. Our place is to do whatever we can to serve his will and obey his call.
That wraps up the portion of Shemot. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion Vayera, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new episodes. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.